The artist goes, okay, I have to look at every one of these 10,000 layers and have to bring them down one by one by one. And the more layers come down, the closer I start getting to my biggest insecurities.
Right? Then it gets harder.
Then it gets harder.
Yeah.
Yep.
As you start to deal with your vulnerabilities, you become more whole. You become a bigger person. And all of a sudden, a little level of you is healed.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We want to debate, investigate, and entertain.
Join us as we challenge the human experience
by speaking to people who impact the world through art.
Chapter 2, Podcast 2, Chum Ahelopola.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey. Firstly, we would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present, on which this podcast recording today takes place.
Yes, indeed. And it has been a couple of months since we've spoken to you last, Lauren. This feels like a bit of a reunion.
Well, it's been a couple of months since we've spoken to you, Nick.
I always love that you take this down a path that I never, ever know where to go with it. But it's good to speak to you again. This is like a school reunion. You haven't aged a bit, Lauren.
A two-month school reunion.
Yeah.
But you know, you're minus the beard.
The beard.
You look a little strange to me. That's not new.
That's not new at all. But hey, look, we might have a few new listeners, Lauren Bailey, and I'll explain why in a moment. But I think one thing we never do on this podcast is really explain exactly what this podcast comprises
why we're here.
And why we're here. So if it is your first time, where have you been, number one? But it is also good to know what you're in store for over the next 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how we edit. So the way this works, you'll hear a little bit about us, our dreams, our artistic journey. You'll hear from both myself and Lauren about that. We'll then sit down with a storyteller. Now, they're going to tell us all about how they are challenging the world through their art. We'll take a break at about half time and we'll recommend a few tools in our little segment called The Artist Toolkit. And then, of course, we finish the interview and we look at the upcoming month, what it holds for us artistically after that, and any events on the horizons that we'd like to recommend. So that is basically the podcast in a nutshell.
And as you mentioned earlier, we do have some really exciting news.
We do.
We have just recently joined forces with new podcast network Earbuds, which, which is brought to you by digital production company Media Creatures. Now, the podcasts range from wine to TV binge-watching, football to, of course, storytelling. And Earbuds brings listeners the most innovative and entertaining locally produced podcasts from talented podcasters like us to reflect the sound of the city. And we're extremely proud to be a part of what Earbuds is up to. And, of course, we're bringing our own focus on speaking to artists who are impacting the world through art to the collective. And we'd love to just give a big thank you to both Matt Nielsen and Nev Sporovska from the Earbuds Network in helping us transition smoothly into the podcast family.
Yeah, it is exciting times. And being part of the network, it pretty much means that we can cross-collaborate in a lot of different ways, whether it be through speaking with other podcasts in the Earbuds family, looking at other interesting guests. Also, things like today where we're sitting in their studio recording
with these really
sexy mics. Like, you sound very luscious right now, Lauren. And I hope that everyone can hear that out there.
They'll be like, oh, she sounds better than in real life.
Yeah,
that's weird. Anyway, of course, our last podcast was with the fantastic Buddy Miller, who is, among other things, senior lecturer of acting at the Victorian College of the Arts. And at that time, Nick, you had quite a lot on your plate. You talked about the stress of dealing with anxiety. It's been 2 months since we last recorded, and I just wondered how you're traveling.
To give you a little taste, I've traveled back and forth from Melbourne many, many times, more than I can actually count. And I also managed to fit in a trip to San Francisco for work as well. You're right, I did cover a lot about the anxiety that I was dealing with last time we spoke.
Yeah.
But I don't want to harp on that too much, because I think we spoke quite candidly about that last time, and hopefully it was helpful for anyone out there going through similar things. What I wanted to talk about is more about a lesson that I think I've got out of the last 2 months. And I have been traveling a lot with work as a content producer. One of the things that I get to do in that job is travel with a lot of leadership teams. I wanted to ask you a question first, Lauren.
Uh-oh.
I mean, how often do you think of yourself as a leader in what you do creatively? two parts too, right? Think of yourself as an individual and also in regards to how you collaborate with others.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I am actually at the moment taking part in a online program, and I'll talk more about that maybe next month because we'll be a little further along in it. But it is meaning that I'm looking at the different areas of my life.
Mm.
Obviously, I'm an actor. I have a job to supplement that. I also write and increasingly produce, and I consider myself a filmmaker. And one of the things that the lessons so far have exposed is that in some of those areas, I definitely feel like a leader.
Mm.
And in others, I don't.
There's work to be done.
Which is kind of really nice to acknowledge.
I believe every leader worth their salt feels like that. And I had two different leaders on two different conferences. One leader, he got up on stage. They're going through massive amounts of change. He got up there, and as a metaphor for change, he spoke about his expensive house and how he made it run well. Now, for a company going through a massive amount of change, imagine how the people sitting in that room felt when there's just been massive job cuts and he's talking about his expensive house and how he needs to inspire them to change the way that they're doing things, right?
Yeah.
Leader number one. Leader number two acknowledged there was a massive amount of change in his particular business. He acknowledged his failures. He committed to being on the front line to making it work. And then after he spoke, he spent 2 to 3 hours sitting down with people that he'd never met before and hearing what they had to say. And literally owning up to things that he needed to do better as well as what the company needed to do better. Now, as far as inspiring, I think we know which one's better, right? In regards to being a leader.
Yeah.
And so what I really loved about that second leader and what I took out of that is the gap between what you say and what you do can be massive. Remember a few podcasts ago, I said, I'm going to go off the back of Maze's interview, and spend a couple of days writing.
In the wilderness.
In the wilderness writing comedy. Hasn't happened. So the gap between what I've said I want to do and what I am doing.
Yeah.
I've got to learn to close that and start to allow those actions to happen, or else what is it? It's just a bunch of hot air.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think in that, definitely in your leadership example, that you also need to allow yourself the time and the space to act on the things that you say that you're doing.
Mm. But at some point too, I think there's that point where you go, right.
But at some point you've got to stop talking about it and actually do. Absolutely.
It. Yeah.
I know that you don't want to go down a rabbit hole of, I guess, the rabbit hole of mental health.
Yep.
Because we did talk about it quite a lot on the last podcast.
Yep.
But I do just want to say that it's nice to see you today and to see that you seem much more grounded and at ease than the last time we recorded.
Mm.
And just to acknowledge that that doesn't mean things just go away, right?
Mm. No.
Those things continue, and it's healthy to, like that leader, acknowledge what is going on in your life and that we continue to deal with that stuff.
Yeah, if you don't talk about it, it can become a monster of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm going to go off this whole leadership thing that you brought up here.
Please.
Because the challenge that I feel in my career at the moment is to sort of align all the various projects I'm working on and to feel comfortable spread across those projects.
Mm.
But I had a really interesting experience since we last recorded. And I mentioned in the last podcast that I was about to start Chinese circus pole classes with Anne Chung at the Women's Circus.
Did. Yes. Oh, yes. Tell us more.
I did that and it was fantastic. And I'm going to sign up for another term of classes there because it was so physically demanding.
Yeah.
But what was really interesting for me was the improvement in my skill level from the first class, to just over a month later.
And I remember talking to you actually about that time. You were quite frustrated in some ways about what the gap between what you physically could imagine yourself doing and what you could actually do, wasn't
it? But this has been a real theme for me, this idea of what we see in our heads and what we can imagine that we can do.
Yeah.
The biggest lesson for me from these classes has been I was so out of my depth in that first class and I had all the will in the world to want to be able to do what I was being asked to do, but couldn't see how I could do it.
Yeah.
And I actually cried in the first class and just from exhaustion and I just felt really vulnerable, and it's made me realize that going forward, and here we talk about things we're going to do, going forward every quarter, I want to find something to learn that I've never done before and have no experience in, because it taught me so much about myself and how I apply myself and how I feel when I don't know what's going on. That's invaluable. And it's spread across the rest of my life, because for the last couple of months, I keep thinking about the images that I give myself. In July, I was talking to someone about perseverance and how to keep going. And she said, oh, you're so strong. You've made this film. I said, isn't that funny? Because strength, I think, it's an outside perspective. Correct. You may look at me and feel that way. Do I feel that way? And the idea of climbing mountains, if we felt like we were climbing a mountain, then we go, cool, I'm halfway.
Yeah.
I can see the top. You know, that would give you the drive to get there. But often you just feel like you're on a flat. And then more recently, I felt like a little bit of a mouse on a wheel. Well, okay, it's great that image has come up, but I don't think that image is healthy for me.
No. I want to talk about images a little bit more. When you say you use images month to month, in what way? Do you, just to explore this, because I'm quite interested.
Yeah.
Monthly, do you go, this is the image that I focus on?
No, I don't, but I might now. This is stuff that comes up. I'll find myself describing something and it'll present an image, and I'll look at it and go, oh, is that an image that is useful to me?
That's really interesting.
And maybe the idea of a mountain is. I just think that's a library that we can add to what other images are useful to us for how we... And this one of a mouse on a wheel, I found myself describing myself to people like
very
that.
Very, very visceral, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm like, well, that's not necessarily a healthy image.
Right.
Then I tried to imagine a happy mouse on a wheel.
Yeah, still, he's
and
on a wheel.
And I was like, yeah, no, he's still on
still
a wheel.
Going in circles,
I still need
isn't
to keep going.
No, it's interesting. So I really love that. And that's an interesting concept to explore because, once again, I'm quite a visual person. So that, to me, evokes emotion when I, you know, when you talk about the rat on the wheel or the mouse on the wheel.
I said I was a mouse, not
okay,
a rat.
Okay, sure. Yeah, but once again, you can see how visceral the rat is as well, right? But that's a really interesting concept, even if you could look to, you know, look at your month ahead and go, well, what's the image that I want my month to look like?
And I think often people might look for it and go, oh, a holiday. They can see a holiday coming up and they have an image of what them on that holiday is like, and it inspires them to do things in the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
But that's not always going to be the case, and you need to have positive images about where you're at now.
Yep.
So
I think we're going to talk a lot about this particular topic in the next 45 minutes, especially around going back to your Chinese pole and challenging yourself and overcoming obstacles. I think that's going to be a big topic as we chat to the wonderful actor, director, writer and acting school founder and also Sri Lankan cricket enthusiast, Chum Ehelapola. Right, ladies and gentlemen, we are lucky enough to be joined by Chum Ehelapola.
Perfect.
Welcome, Chum, all the way from LA, back to, well, you've got a few hometowns really, haven't you? But this is Sydney's kind of one of them.
Sydney's definitely one of my hometowns. Perth, kind of, yeah.
And Sri Lanka as well.
And Sri Lanka. Yeah. Sri Lanka's my original home. And New Zealand, because I was born in New Zealand. I'm so lost. I don't know what to do in cricket if Australia, New Zealand and Sri Lanka is the tri-nations.
Do you have a...
Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka, yeah. The home.
Yeah,
the original.
The motherland. The original.
Very good. But we're not here to talk about cricket.
No, we're not. I wish we were, but we're not.
No, that's true. We just want to hear a little bit about, first of all, your story.
As an artist, I want to affect people and tell stories that matter. We have a voice as artists, and we should use it. Sometimes it is purely to entertain, joke, and sometimes it is to affect change. My most inspiring moment as an artist... I think I do not have one moment per se, but many little moments. When they happen, inspire me to know that I'm on my path, following what I want to be doing. But I must admit, my most inspiring moment is probably when Keanu Reeves was quizzing me about a project I did, and his face was like, wow, this sounds awesome and difficult. And I was like, dude, this is Keanu Reeves.
For our listeners' reference, you said there isn't one particular moment of inspiration, but many little moments. Perhaps you can tell us about one of the little moments that you remember.
Okay, I'll tell you. I was sitting there, my wife was pregnant, and we were paying insurance in America. And we know the debacle, the insurance system over there.
Yeah.
So we were paying out of pocket, and it was a lot of money. and I was just about to have a baby.
I love that this is a little moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds huge.
No, yeah, it's kind of big. But I just remembered that because, you know, we start thinking acting, we think inspiring, and we literally think, what's my acting moment? You know, what's that big job? And I guess that's why I'm not inspired, because I'm not inspired by booking anymore, because that's kind of the job, right? That's what we do. Sure, when I first started, I was like, oh my God, I booked a job. This is awesome. I'm so inspired. You know, what's the purpose of booking? You know, like what's the deeper thing? Why do I want to book? Not to work. Of course, I want to work. But if that was it, and I've seen actors, that's it. There's no life in their eyes. The inspiring moments for me now are the purpose stuff, right? Like that there's a purpose here. And this was a purpose. I was panicking because I was like, oh, shit, I've got to... Can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome, right.
We're not bleeping that.
No. I said shit and Lauren kind of blushed. It's going to get worse, Lauren. strap yourself in. Put your, yeah, right. And I was panicking because I was like, man, we've moved to Los Angeles. Everything is expenditure. It's so hard to book in the country. I'm having a baby and I'm just like, oh my God, the insurance, the cost, the fees, the Aussie dollar wasn't going up, it was going down. And, you know, but my wife and I just were like, this is our new challenge, you know, this is the kind of new thing we want to do. And I'd gotten myself in Australia to a place where I'd worked for every network, I was doing shows, I was being offered roles, and, you know, I loved it. It was awesome. In the same token, you look at what's being offered in America and you're like, wow, as an actor, as an artist, you're like, I want these challenges, you know, I want to try this world. And so we did the move and I was like, oh, wow, how am I going to pay for my family?
Yeah, it becomes very real then, doesn't it?
It's like dead real. You know, it's not this kind of thing of, oh, I'll go to Hollywood and I'm Hollywood and, you know, and then you're like, wow, I'm in Hollywood. I've got the full gamut of representation. So what? I've got to survive.
It raises the stakes.
Oh, my God. It was like life or death, yeah. Right? And I had raised the stakes. And insurance would have been, once my son was born, and to include me, because honestly, I was travelling on my credit card insurance.
Which is a thing.
Which is a thing.
Not ideal.
But you can't do that when you change your residential address.
Oh, true. Right? Yeah.
So every 6 months, I'm like, if something happens to me, I'm going to have to use my platinum card insurance. That's how I was living my life, right?
No, yeah.
It would have been about $1,500 US a month just to insure my family, right? No. So now we're talking about $12,000 to $15,000 US a year. And I was just like going, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? Then we gave birth, right? And my beautiful little son sitting there. And I looked at my wife and we were just so happy because we were just like, this is like, it's just unbelievable. And my agent calls me and goes, you got a call back today, right, for a commercial. Call my agent and said, dude, I'm just holding my son.
Yeah.
Your call back can get fucked.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I am not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? I'm staying here with my wife and my son. And my agent's awesome. They're like, of course, totally, we'll cancel it. No, my God, this is amazing. You know, congratulations, blah, blah, blah. So told them to go away. They would cancel it. I'm sitting there with my wife. We're at Cedar Sinai in Beverly Hills, which is the kind of hospital where all the stars deliver.
Yeah, right.
There's irony in that. And I'm sitting there, and my wife looks at me, and she goes, you should go to your call back. And I was like, no, I'm not going to my call back. I'm sitting right here. And she's like, babe, there's no safer place I can be right now.
Yeah.
Right? You can't do anything here. Right? If something goes wrong, I'm not going to look at you. I'm pressing a red button.
Yeah.
Right? And people that are far more skilled are going to turn up, and I'm going to push you as far away from me. Right? And you're going to sit and watch. So this is the perfect place. And I'm sitting there going, okay, cool. And I'll never forget this moment, right? I'm in love with my wife, and you know, for all bunch of other reasons, and this is one of them as well. She looked at me and she goes, why are we here? Like, why are we here in Los Angeles? And I was like, oh, you're right. She said, who do you want to be to your son? I'm sitting there looking at her, and she's like, we didn't come here to play small. And I was like, okay, cool, all right, cool. So I drove out to Santa Monica, and I turn up to this callback, and it's a cattle call. The callback is a cattle call. Aww. The thing is, I haven't slept for 2 days. I don't care about this audition. I care about my son. So just walk in, act, blah, 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 leave.
Yes.
Right? That's literally what it was. Whereas before, it's like, turn up, pray, please.
Yeah.
desperate, pathetic, pathetic. All right? And then I was like, blah, 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 left. went, I was like, I gotta get my wife a nice kale salad because that's what you do in LA. And she's just giving birth, so I gotta give her some healthy shit. Yeah. And as I bought the salad, bought the food, I'm like, get really healthy stuff. And I'm walking along. I was just so happy to see my little son, right? My agent calls me and goes, he just booked it.
And what was the role?
It was one of the leads in a commercial, yeah. And the pay was in five figures. That got me into the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh, fantastic.
And my insurance went to $1,500 a year.
Wow.
This is why everyone wants to get into the guild, because you get looked after. So I got into SAG, and everything changed. I turned up to my wife, and she looked at me, and she's like, she had this big smile on her face. I was like, I get it.
Yeah.
That was an inspiring moment for me, because I'm like, wow, just do what you love. And when my wife said, who do you want to be for your son? I was like, I want to be an artist for my son. I don't want to be a desperate actor for my son. Yeah. I don't want to be someone who's kind of like, you know, you're both actors, and we all know that journey of an actor, right? Where sometimes we forget the art, and it's the business that takes over, right? And you're going, oh, yeah. Am I going to deliver for my agent? Because if I don't book, they're going to fire me. And you start to play that game, and you go into that world, and there's so much negative emotions attached to that, and everything from insecurity, envy. And I know when I first decided I wanted to be an actor, God, man, I think I was like in year... I was like 10 years old, and someone like was like, you want to audition for a play? I was like, okay. And I just started reading. I was like, I love this. I wasn't thinking about showreels and IMDBs and agents and shit, right? I was just like, I'm on stage, and this is cool. And I think what happens is the older we get, the more ingrained in the business we get, you know, like you guys, you forget the love. You're all part of the business. And then the business kind of doesn't, it narrows you. And then when you book something, it's more like, you know, you forget about the art you booked.
Yeah.
You think about the job you booked. And so, yeah, and that was kind of something that happened to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. This is about life. Yeah, this is about life.
Holy crap. So that wasn't a small moment.
No. But I was like, I get the question now.
Yeah. I want to go a little bit further back just for a moment, because I know we spoke a bit about this before we started recording. And it's around your childhood. You arrived in Australia and you went from Perth to Sydney, but there's so much more before that. You started to talk about some terrible things that you saw in Sri Lanka, but also the happy memories that you have of living there. So how do you think that journey has shaped you as an actor?
I think that journey has shaped me as an actor by kind of helping me understand gratitude. Because we lived a tough life, because my parents are immigrants, because they came over during kind of like white Australia and stuff like that. Yeah. And God, when I grew up in Perth, the racism that I endured was unbelievable. And, you know, and we came from a war-torn country. I was old enough to see horror, to see death, to see misery. And, you know, when you're young enough and you're a sponge when you're young, you know, that stuff stays in your head. And so then I think when I came here to Australia... It wasn't conscious, right? I remember it was not conscious. It was innately in me after having, I guess, been experiencing shit that children shouldn't be in. You know, one of the moments was we were in a boarding school. My brother and I was in year one. My brother was in kindy. And we're playing, and then we hear the boarding master come out and it's like, go inside. To us two, we're like, wow. We look down, the house below us has just been bombed.
In our research for today, we listened to an interview you did with Ansuyu Nathan for another Aussie in LA podcast, which is a fantastic podcast. And you told her a story about what you and the other children needed to do when a bomb hit. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So what happened was all the older people were standing outside, okay, because you just don't know what's going to happen. The assumption is, you know, you don't know if you're going to get bum rushed. You know, you don't know if you're the next house. You don't know what's going on. But the younger kids, there's only three of us, had to go inside. And I think we got told that, like, you kind of hold on to these bars. The Sri Lankan windows have bars on them, and you're just holding on to them. And I remember holding on to them, looking at my little brother and my friend going, why aren't the adults here? Why is it just us? And then we found out later that if a house gets bombed or whatever explodes, you know, kind of like you can just go out. And if you're holding on to these bars, you'll go out. You'll follow the bar out, you know, and if you're young enough and light enough, you just go whoosh. And I just remember sitting there looking at my brother, looking up at the sky, going, this is not right, you know, like, I can't, I'm too young to be here. I want my mum and my dad. And I think all those kind of things were ingrained in me, and they're not conscious, they're so subconscious.
but it gave me a drive. So when I came to Australia, I was like, wait, there's no death? I have mum and dad next to me?
Knowing you as I do, one of the things that I get from you is an amazing energy, one that is thankful to do what you do, and an amazing ability to communicate that to people as well. So I think that makes you a little bit of a powerhouse, right? But it's an energy that is uniquely you.
Yeah, right.
Of where you've come from, possibly.
Well, the thing is that, like, you know, you find out you are your obstacles. If you think that you are your success, then you're kind of doomed for failure, you know, because then you're living off your ego. But if you realize that you are kind of like your obstacles, then each day's a new challenge, you know, something to kind of overcome, something to... And so when you overcome it, you're just full of gratitude because you're like, wow.
And if you follow that through, our obstacles are what make us unique.
Exactly. And we all know that. You know, we all know that. But it's so hard to actually kind of embody that and live it.
That's... Wow. Yeah, I was just grabbing my pen to write that
down. You seem to know with great certainty on arriving here in Australia that acting was the right direction for you. Do you feel that that has allowed you to heal some of those memories from your childhood?
Oh my God, yeah. Are you kidding me? Of course it has. Here's the thing, okay? Artists are some of the most bravest people in the world. Without a doubt, you know, people that go on war and frontline and fight for a greater good to protect us and stuff like that, you know, they're absolutely amazing. An Olympian who dedicates their whole life to a dive that's going to take them 8 seconds. 8 years on 8 seconds. I mean, God, you know, like, we know what it's like. I'm like, well, I got 2.5 minutes of this scene, which I've been prepping for 3 weeks, right? It's a little taste of it, you know, you try. I think artists are super brave because to tell a story, it's not how you say your lines. It's the fucking last thing in the world anyone's thinking about. What any artist is looking to do is find the vulnerability. And then you as a person have to relate to that character's vulnerability. Now, no one wants to be fucking vulnerable. But the artist goes, okay, I have to look at every one of these 10,000 layers and have to bring them down one by one by one. And the more layers come down, the closer I start getting to my biggest insecurities.
Right? Then it gets harder.
Yeah. Yep. And then just when you realize, for me, you know, I was like, I kept saying, like, you know, I'm looking in the mirror, I'm like, I'm not white. You know, that sucks because I'm in Australia and everything's fucking white. I'm not white. And so then, you know, my walls have come down and I'm going, okay, well, let's look for some brown people on television so you're inspired. And I'm like, really? Like, how am I going to find any of those people on there? They're not. And so you keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And then you realize that artistically, as you start to deal with your vulnerabilities, you become more whole. You become a bigger person. Yeah. And all of a sudden, a little level of you is healed because all of a sudden you go, you know what? I am sexy. And I had to go to acting class to work that out. You know? I didn't just one day wake up and go, yeah, I am sexy. You had to go and work with tutors and practitioners who love you and who want the best for you and help you figure these things out. You know, I had some amazing acting teachers who made me realize that being brown was powerful.
Can we go back to the idea that you mentioned of the characters that you see on screen? You played Professor De Silva in the funny and insightful web series How to Talk Australians. The web series invites us to laugh at ourselves as Australians as it mines the depths of every aspect of the Australian stereotype. For instance, one of the instructors at the fictional Delhi College of Linguistics states, a recent survey reveals that 30% of Australians are casual racists, which means 70% are full-time. In the current Australian social political climate, how important do you feel this idea of being able to laugh at ourselves is?
It's crucial. It's crucial. I was literally having this conversation yesterday with a friend of mine saying, in our attempts, and this could be controversial, right, what I'm saying, but I'm just saying it from my own ethnic point of view. In our attempts to be culturally sensitive, we've become polarized. So now it's less about the intention of what you say and more about what words came out of your mouth. Okay? And I know when I was younger, my friends, right, said the most racist shit to me, but they loved me deeply.
Yeah.
Right? But we communicated that way. Mm. And I remember what happened.
by default, we were communicating our own uniqueness to each other. And actually, in a weird, fucked up way, right, we were celebrating it. So my nickname was Blackie, right? I loved it. Okay? Because all of a sudden, Blackie was me and it was unique.
Well, you know, growing up, so I grew up in a country town of 500 people.
Yeah.
We had a mate called Wog.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We loved, like, we didn't know what that term, the, I guess, intention of that term was at the time in the way of going, we're not calling that you that to ostracize you. That's your unique name and we love you for it.
Yes.
So I totally get this idea of polarization. Because obviously, you know, when I came to the city and you started realizing that, hold on, maybe that wasn't the right name for, you start to battle with a heap of things internally because it wasn't coming from a place of hatred or a place of ostracizing Scotty. So what's going on in the world when that happens?
Totally.
Yeah, and if you take that further, the result is that you start examining everything you've said and you become so focused on yourself and what you're saying that you're actually disconnecting yourself in the process.
Completely. And now you've censored yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And now you've completely censored yourself. And now ethnics have become a group of people that you have to tiptoe. Not because you've meant to, because I don't want to say anything to hurt anybody, but intentionally you're a good person. Yeah, you never would. But now words have been taken away from you. And so now it's like I can't even communicate because I'm an Anglo-Saxon person who's grown up in Australia. I don't want to offend someone because I haven't been to Sri Lanka. I haven't been. I don't understand the cultural world. And I just think the Age, or one of the newspapers interviewed me about this, and I kind of said the same thing. I was like, I remember growing up with the Cropless Now, and they said the most fucked up things, right? And it was brilliant, you know? It was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Because no one was deliberately saying the Wogs or whatever are shit, but we were celebrating it. You know, we're celebrating that there was this group of people and they had their idiosyncrasies and we heightened them and sure, there were stereotypes, right? But we're celebrating that ethnicity and then you've got this white person who you kind of, is a counterpoint to it and we ridicule the white person as much as we ridicule the Wogs as much. And this show that I just did, I'll be honest, my agency first called me and said, there's a show they want you for. And I said, okay, can you tell me explain to me? And she explained to me, I was like, I don't want to do it. It's my first thing. And they're like, okay, totally understand. They called back and they said, look, they really want you to do it and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, ugh, it just sounds like so cliched and blah, blah, blah. And then she goes, oh, by the way, Tony Rogers is directing it. And I went, say yes. Just say yes. Because here's a man who understands the complexity of this thing. And I was like, oh, this guy's going to do something with this. And I am prepared to put on the accent. Because right now in my career, I'm pretty like, if there's a reason for this and we can educate, inform, inspire, empower, then fine, I'll put on an accent. But if we're just kind of like reaffirming what everyone knows, then I'm not going to do it. But like, if you want me to be a quick mark dude and put on an accent, okay, fine. What's the thing that no one knows that they're going to learn about life through this person right now? If it's nothing, then I'm not doing it. But if it's this, that this person's deeply in love, and love looks like this, then I'll be a quickie mark dude and put on an accent. And that's where the stereotypes all suffer.
Recently, you wrote some work with part of a comedy group called Sketch Bastards.
Yeah.
And you did a short, which was basically it was called Fairy Tale Immigration, was the name of it. And it was actually picked up by Funny or Die. It's a very humorous sketch. I suggest that you go out and find this sketch to watch it. You actually play, and you wrote this, right?
Yep.
You wrote this, and you play Aladdin.
Yep.
As he is trying to make his way through American immigration following Trump's election. So this is a stereotype, but we had a bit to learn from this character, didn't we? Didn't we? Do you want to share a little bit about the purpose of what you were trying to do with that video?
So and this is that part, you know, where like actors have a voice, right? Artists have a voice. Trump came into power. And
what?
I can't even say it.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel like I have to go and wash myself.
Correct.
Have a shower. He turned up. The anti-Muslim, anti-ethnic rhetoric that started was just shocking, you know? And I've got so many, like, Anglo-Saxon white friends who were just as appalled as I was, you know? So this wasn't a brown, white,
freaking ethnic thing. This is just a decency thing, you know? And it was like anti-Muslims. I was going, okay, right. Well, let's look at some American characters that we love, right? That we think are quintessentially American. And then I kind of was like, well, Aladdin's from the Middle East. He'd have to be Muslim. Yeah. Right? I'm like, so what would we do if Aladdin got the same treatment as these seven countries, you know, this travel ban that they're put on them? And so the sketch bastards and I, and, you know, these actors that I've worked with are amazing. You know, one of them goes, Johnny.
Is this the guy who played the monkey?
Oh, no, that's Luis. Luis played Apu. And Luis is Mexican. He's Hispanic. He's from Spain.
you told me, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this.
Sure.
Said that, I don't want to ruin it for people, but he comes in, he's obviously human, but he comes in as a monkey, essentially, like the full movement. Yeah. And you said that that hadn't been planned. You went to do a take, and he literally walked in or crawled and sort of hopped in like a monkey.
Yeah. And I was just like, because I wrote about it, I directed it as well, right? So, and the good thing, if you can direct, you just get the best actors and let them do their thing. Yeah. Right? We all know that. So I kind of just said, here's the scripts, do something. And I remember the door opened, and like Apu walks in, my monkey friend.
Yeah.
And I looked at him, and he's dressed like a monkey. He's got little jocks on. He's got little like purple jocks on. And I looked at him, and instead of walking in like kind of like a human and sitting down, and kind of like, so in the sketch, Abu's kind of like my lawyer.
Yeah.
And he's like talking about the 1980 treaty of refugees. Yeah. But he kind of like stumbled in like a monkey, and he's like talking like a monkey. And I'm doing everything I can to not just lose it. But I looked at the other side, and Johnny and Jim were losing it. They just like given up. They were gone. And so my whole thing with...
We will put a link to this.
Put a link to it. Yeah. Put a link up. It's on Funny or Die. And yes, at the end of that, I was like, awesome. You know, like, you know, hopefully it resonates. But I feel good. You know, I got a chance to do something and like, you know, communicate my point of view about the world at the moment. Yeah. And do it through comedy. We all know that. You know, if you can make someone laugh, they're going to care more. But I could easily get the violins out and kind of do a really sad story about this. And I'm sure it'd be just as poignant.
Yeah.
But I love comedy. And I think if you can use comedy to tell stories and change the world, I think there's something really powerful about that.
We'll be back with the interview in a moment. It's Artist Toolkit segment time. And of course, this month we are talking about a book or books that we have been reading of late that have helped us on our artistic journeys.
Yes.
So you and I will chip in. And then we've also got a book recommendation from next month's podcast guest.
How exciting is that?
Super exciting. Such a motivational, inspiring dude. Oh, my goodness.
We'll talk about him later. Can't even.
So what's your book recommendation, Nick?
Hey, we've got a couple, and I'm going to go through them really quickly because these have all helped in different ways. There's a book called 18 Minutes, Find Your Focus, Master Distraction, and Get the Right Things Done. It's by a guy named Peter Bregman. This book, to this day, I still use the little thing that he set out in regards to every day, this is how you set up your to-do list.
Oh,
I still
fantastic.
Use it to this day. And that was maybe 8-9 years ago.
Cool.
I read this book. The second one is Shana Kennedy, The Life Plan. Beautiful book. You ride in it. It's got beautiful pictures, which is only a part of it. It also does some wonderful things, and it's based around simple strategies to a meaningful life. So it helps you build up, I guess, your purpose and what you want to take out of your life day to day. That's my book recommendations.
And I can borrow them from the Nick Kane library.
You certainly can. You Fantastic. Know it. Okay, yes, talk to me.
Yeah, so I was going so through good. This whole vulnerability phase, and I actually was speaking to Buddy Miller, who was over in America teaching at that point. Mm-hmm. He recommended to me that I look up Brené Brown's book on vulnerability, which is called Daring Greatly.
Daring Greatly.
This is like, right, Wonderful okay, book. This is what I need. Went to the bookstore, didn't have it.
Oh, you should have got it from the Nick Kane bookstore once again.
It was time is very imperative. Yeah, okay. Of the essence, thank you. They didn't have it.
Yep.
They had the next book, Rising Strong. So I was like, well, hello, that's clearly the book that I was meant to buy
today.
She
got all the bugs out of the first book and the second book, great.
Yep. So, of course, it does touch on some of the stuff about vulnerability, but it's talking about rising back from that place of vulnerability and how you...
use that. It's great. I'm halfway through it.
You are.
Because I've been reading it when I feel like I need a top up.
Yep.
I just want to mention, because I think it totally ties in with a couple of things we're talking about on the podcast today, this section where she talks about she writes permission notes, and she uses them in a slightly different way. But I've taken this idea and run with it. You know, you wake up and you're like, oh, I've got all this stuff on today. I feel like it's going to be really hard. Or I'm looking at this thing tonight and I can just see things not working out the way, the easiest way possible.
Yep.
To give yourself permission.
Yep.
And so I'm stopping and going, I give myself permission tonight to enjoy this event. Or I give myself permission tonight to find...
You write this note, you give it to yourself.
They're mental notes. Okay. But anyway, I got this idea from this book, and it's great. And I've really been enjoying it. Rising Strong by Brené Brown. That is my book.
Get out there and purchase. Hey, and one more. A challenge for the actor, Uta Hagen. Have you read that book?
Oh, I haven't read the book, but I have. Get involved. I did. Oh, sorry, Nick. I feel like I've let you down.
You haven't.
I haven't mentioned any acting
books.
I'll
lend it to you. It is. Well, I just thought, you know, we're talking about the craft books. That is an absolute beauty that I think everyone should read. It's on the must-read list. Lauren Bailey, I'll lend it
Fantastic.
To you.
So if I'm not on the podcast next month, I'm busy reading all of Nick's books. And, of course, we do have one more book recommendation from the fantastic Ali Kadim. He's a parkour practitioner, filmmaker, movement specialist, and martial artist, and next month's podcast guest. Here we go.
So it's called Body Mind Mastery. It's by Dan Millman. And he talks about how, for example, you can progress in your specific art form or sport or your craft, whatever it may be. Yeah, and he dives into different techniques and he dives into different examples, and he's got a lot of great content. So for anyone who feels like they want to find what they love, or they feel like they're lacking that kind of direction in their life, so it's a good read. You'll find a lot of great examples, and it might inspire you to push or to, you know, quit your job. I don't know.
On your YouTube channel, there is a film that you directed, produced, edited, and performed in. Well, there are a few of them. But the one that I wanted to ask about is the short film Intersecting Beauty, which is a very different feel to your work that you've done with Sketch Bastards, and examines quite an open and vulnerable moment in time. In this world of creating your own content and being able to speak about things as an artist, can you talk about where the idea for the film came from?
That was at a time when people, the idea of sexuality in the Middle East, you know, it's a kind of confusing idea. And I come from a pretty conservative culture. We have arranged marriages. You know, it's not celebrated if you're gay. It's not celebrated if you have sexual expression. You know, it's all kind of reserved, contained. Don't offend the family. Don't offend the village. Don't offend, you know, don't bring disrepute and just bullshit like that. And I just had this moment, right, where I was kind of like, I think I was walking down the cross and I saw, at the time, I think she was a drag queen performing, right? And I was kind of like, well, obviously it's a dude. But a new side to their personality has come out, right? And they're expressing it. Right, and they feel great about it, and but this person has the freedom here to do it publicly, and in any way, shape, or form, however, whatever sexual orientation you are, or you know, like if anything you want, from cross dressing all the way to whatever, right? And you got a bunch of dickheads who'll judge you, right? But you always need your fucking idiots, and you can do that when you're living in countries like in Australia and America and stuff like
this
that,
is true. Yeah.
Where you know the majority consensus is that way, right? But you try doing that in like in Sri Lanka or Iraq, it becomes very different, right?
Yeah, and what's really amazing about that film, and we'll include a link on the website, and I encourage listeners to watch it, is that you're not only analysing those aspects of Muslim culture, but you also comment on how women are trapped, restricted, perceived, and observed. There's so much going on.
Yeah. When I wrote that, I think I tried not to write black and white, right? I'm trying not to write definitive because the world isn't definitive. I want, at the end of this, for people to be like, what the hell did I just watch? And I have no idea where I am with it. I don't know. I want to talk to someone. And it was interesting because when I did that, Rachel Ward, who's this amazing director, she watched it. And we were shooting The Straits in Cairns.
And we were in Papua New Guinea at the time, I think. And I said to Rach, I was like, Rach, can you watch this TV show for me? I mean, this thing that I shot, and just give me your opinion on it. And we watched it. She watched it. And then she came to me and she goes, all right, chum, we're gonna go and have dinner. I need to talk to you about this. And I was I was like, it's so bad. Oh, Rach, be nice to me. Be nice. You know.
He's about to go, it wasn't mine.
I need to tell you to stop being a filmmaker. And Rachie just sat down with me and just started breaking it down. And I didn't realize that I'd actually stumbled upon something that had this much potency, you know. And then I think Pete Andrikita's watched it because he was on set as well, right? So I said, Pete, Rach watched it. Can you watch it? And Pete watched it. And Pete had kind of like a slightly different point of view. And I was like going, oh, I think I've done it. I think I did what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Right? He said, I didn't want anyone to be black and white. I wanted people to sit on different sides of the fence. But you know what's happening? We're communicating about it. We're talking about it, you know? Like there's no villain. There's no hero. They're both as good and bad as each other. And what these two are doing in the film is like not getting each other. They're not getting each other because they're both standing on their side of the fence. They're both trying to understand each other, but it's like a token effort. Instead of actually deeply going, okay, I don't like this, but I'm actually going to ask honest questions. And when you're in a therapy session, you're kind of like, wait, are you? Because I've had enough therapy in my life to know this. We all. I'm kind of like, yeah, you know, it's not like your best friend asking you a therapy question because you're like, oh, you're invested in me. Therapy question, when they ask you, it's like, okay, you have an agenda. And these two characters both have agendas. And for me...
And the film is set in a psychologist's office.
Psychologist's office. And right at the end, you look at it and you're like, well, what's the end to this? And I don't know. And I think the greater idea of that is that when you wear the niqab, which is you can only see the eyes, right? The more zanier idea I had, right, was that, wait, if you actually wanted to express your feminine side, you could with no one knowing because you could put the hijab and the niqab on and you could be a dude under there who's like safely exploring that side of yourself. And then when you don't want to anymore, you take it all off and you come out as yourself. So there's an irony in that, that maybe behind this veil, it's a man living his truth. How would you know? That's the irony. And there was something in that that I found so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, like he could have all the makeup on and no one's judging him. But it's ironical because like he'd get killed probably. If he publicly went out and did that.
And again, it would be a case of having to be who you wanted to be in secrecy.
I remember when we did that as well, like we were going to post it and we were all nervous. You know, we were nervous. And this was, I think, well before the Charlie Hebdo stuff and whatever in France and everything. But we all kind of were like, oh, God, there is an extreme group of kind of the ISIS-based people, fundamentalists, who would hate me. For even commenting about this world.
I just want to say, though, we had a guest called Richard Baker. I don't know if you've ever heard of Richard. Richard's a Walkley award-winning journalist.
Awesome.
Who has uncovered everything from a lot to do with the sort of whole underbelly saga through to the wheat board bribery scandals.
Yeah.
Huge things, right? And he would get the same feeling the day before his article would come out. So he would be like, these are the articles you see on the front of the paper that say this is like, you know, breaking news.
Yeah.
And he's dealing with, well, deadly people, for lack of a better term, you know, dangerous people. But as he said, he goes, if I don't do this, who will? It's driven by purpose.
Yeah.
And I think that's, so to have that kind of reaction, it means the art's worth something, right? It means what you're doing.
Yeah.
Is worth the conversation.
Yeah, 100%. Everything that I've created, you know, as an artist, I don't call myself an actor, you know, we're artists, and, you know, actors are writers, writers are filmmakers, you know, filmmakers are musicians, you know, musicians actually paint, you know, like I worked with Barry Otto on a job, and we're sitting there chatting, and I said to Barry, I said, do you have any advice for me? You know, like, you're like the god.
Yeah.
And he goes, find another form of art that you love. And live it, because then you're just going to build yourself as an artist. And it's like, I paint, I love painting, I paint, and if I can put an exhibition, it's great. So it's all art, and I was kind of like, well, I love telling stories, you know, I just love it. And so whenever I try and tell a story, comedy or drama, I do want to talk about a point of view of life.
There's this guy called Tim McNeil, who's the head of diversity in ABC America. So he's basically, his job is to like diversity in all forms, everything. Directing, film, it's like it's a VP position, right? And I met him, I was pitching stories to him, and him and I became friends. And we developed this Syrian story, right? And it's very HBO, it's very kind of FX, and at the time HBO were interested. But Tim's from ABC, and Tim asked me about it, and I was like, yeah, I said, honestly, it's a little bit cable. I don't know if ABC would want this. And he looked at me and he goes, if it's a slice of life, we're interested. And I was kind of like, oh, I never thought about it that way. You know, yeah. You think, oh, it's a half hour, it's a multicam, it's cable, and you think tone. But will you ever forget, well, okay, tone's great, but what about story?
I want to change tone just a little bit now, mm-hmm. Because there is another string to your bow.
Yes.
You like to say. And it's the Sydney Actors Collective.
Yeah.
Which is a school that you founded. It has multiple locations now.
Yes.
It's a non-beginner's school. And it focuses specifically on, I guess, screen mm-hmm. as a performance mechanism. But you have schools here in Sydney,
mm-hmm.
LA now.
Yeah, we're up LA.
Possibly some others to come.
Yeah. We're looking at Newcastle and Perth at the moment.
Can you tell us a little bit about more around the ethos of the Sydney Actors Collective?
Yeah, totally. I'm not a drama school grad. I started dancing. That's how I got into the whole world. And then I loved acting. And I graduated high school. And I said to Dad, I'm like, you know, I'm going to go be a dancer. Dad was like, get fucked. with a big Indian accent. Yeah, and he didn't say fucked, but like... But I could tell from his eyes
that the message was the same.
The message was kind of there. I kind of understood what was going on, yeah. And I was like, fair call, dude. You know, like, you know, you left, you know, and in your eyes, you're like, there's no future in dancing, right? And I didn't leave a war-torn country so that you can fail. I want you to succeed. I want you to be amazing. So I went to uni and did engineering. And then I went and tried the corporate world for, you know, when you have an engineering degree, you kind of have a bit of a license to go into some interesting jobs. And I did. I tried them all. Just wasn't happening. So I went back to Perth and I was just like, I was lost. I didn't know what was going on. And I remember just going, there's nothing to this. I can't continue like this. And I was like, what do I want to do? I want to act. That's it. You know, I want art. I've tried it, but I don't have drama school training. I'm untrained, you know, so how do I do this? So I packed up my stuff and I came to Sydney and I was like, all right, I'm going to be an actor. And I did this. This is hilarious, okay? I said to someone, I'm like, what do I need to do? And someone goes, you need a headshot. I was like, what's that? They said, it's a photo of your head. And I was like...
Makes sense.
Makes sense. Got it.
It's in the name.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I was like, well, how does that happen? Like, well, you got to take a photo of your face and you send it to agents. So I went to Kmart and bought a disposable camera.
I love this. I love where you're going.
Yeah, I took it, right? And I went and I was my partner at the time. I was like, can you take a photo of my head? And she's like, okay. And we didn't know about lighting. I had no idea. So I kind of like turned the light on in the room and I stood under it. And she just kind of...
Love a good down light.
Perfect for your eyes.
Yeah.
It's a great terrorist look. And she just kind of like points this disposable camera at my face and went click. And I was like, maybe we should take a few more. And she's like, okay. So we kind of crunk. We scroll the little thing. Click. Okay, next one. And we just took a whole bunch of photos. And then I went to Kmart and processed them as little 6x4s and mailed them. No one responded to me, obviously.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I'll get an agent. And somehow I set that off. And one of the big agencies kind of came back to me and said, well, you're never going to be on McLeod's Daughters now, are you? So we're not going to book you. And I was like, oh, that's what professional racism looks like. Okay, cool, yeah. No worries. Yeah, didn't realize that existed. So I did, it's amazing the stuff I've gone through here. And so I went and did just short courses, did stacks and stacks. I was like, what do I want to learn? I want to learn Shakespeare, okay? So I went to Bell Shakespeare and learned with Rowena Ballos and kind of, you know, did some stuff there. Okay, I got to learn screen, so I went here and learned screen. And I think I look at that as the street way of learning, you know? You either go to the institution or you kind of just learn on the streets.
Yeah.
And I kind of learned on the streets. And there was lots of cool things that I learned because I wasn't institutionalized.
Yeah.
But there's amazing thing institutions teach you. So I started this school and the whole philosophy of it, because I look at my life, my career, and I'm like, okay, how did I make it? And I think I made it because I am not afraid of failure anymore, because my whole life was failure. and overcoming it. So the moment you fail and you overcome it, you've succeeded. So that's what success looks like. And from an acting point of view, that's what happened. I'd go on set, I'd fuck up hard, and then I'd go, okay, next time, don't do that, chum. Don't do that. And so when we developed that policy, I thought, oh, no one's teaching that. No one's allowing you to come to class and fail. You know, everyone's expecting you to come to class and, you know, like, hit your turning points. How come you didn't hit this? How come you didn't get that? You know, do this. Oh, perfect. Sit down. And then you kind of go, wow, I succeeded because I'm perfect. And you go, well, why don't you just go back and let's look at that properly. Yeah. And let's spend some time on where you effed up. And let's look at how you overcame that, because that's where the success of the scene was. Right. And so we developed that ethos and we started it, and it was just so good because it's something you can't do that with beginners, right? Because they're still trying to understand the form, trying to understand the craft. When you have people that understand it, then you can kind of flip it, because that's what we do. You know, we take what we think and we flip it. And we all know that that's where the 1% lies. Right? That's where the 1% lies, in taking the obvious, subverting it, flipping it, inverting it, right? And then you go, that's where the magic is. We don't care about perfection, okay? Like, we live in a society now where everyone wants to be perfect, you know? Do the perfect scene. Here's my self-tape. It's perfect. Send it. Right? Someone said, there's no soul in perfection. There's no soul in it. Right? It's perfect.
Because there's no possibility in there. Perfection discounts possibility.
Totally. Where do you go with that? Like, where to now after perfect? Is it a downhill, right? Or you have to maintain perfection, and now you're riddled with anxiety. And so in our school, the whole thing was, you're going to discover your artistry and you're going to discover your barriers, because that's what non-beginner actors need to do, right? We're not trying to work out what an action is. Fuck that, you know what an action is, right? We don't care about objectives, you know what one is. But work out your boundaries as an artist. So now when you are forced to make an action, there's breadth to your action than just an action. And when you look at the greats, you're watching their work, you're like, I can't see your technique. Yeah. And that's where you need to be as an actor.
And you're not actually thinking that at the time. It's after you finish the work, because at the time you're just in it.
You're so in it, you know?
Okay, so here's my thing, and I think this is my last question for today. If success is overcoming failure, can you tell us about a significant failure that you succeeded from?
There's this TV show called Terra Nova. I was auditioning for that. They're looking for this one of the lead roles. Did my first audition, was good. I got a call back. Did my second audition. Found out from casting that, like, I've got another call back. Alex Graves is flying down from LA and he's doing auditions. So I'm in the room with Alex. I'm auditioning. I'm great. I'm like, oh, I'd love to work on a dinosaur TV show with Steven Spielberg, you know, who wouldn't? That'd be awesome. So I vision boarded it. So in my room, I put all the images that I can see of my life artistically in this world. And everything from my dream house, my wife, picture of a dinosaur, Spielberg playing. I had a picture of Spielberg playing with Lego because I was like, awesome. Right? The child. And did all that. And then all of a sudden, we finished that. And then I get a call saying, it's between you and a few. It's a worldwide search, right? You and, like, two other people.
I do remember it, actually.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And then and casting wants you to go in because Fox have given specific direction for you. So I'm sitting in the room and casting are working with me with, like, just me and Christine. And we're just getting it right. Just getting this performance perfect. Trying to work out these notes that they've said to us, right? And Christine's, like, pushing me because, like, you got to hit the notes that Fox have given you, right? Mm. So we're trying stuff, we're doing anything, and then, like, kind of like, okay, I feel like I've found those notes in my own unique way, right, in my own expression. So we left it. Then I get a call saying, all right, Fox are watching your tapes tonight. I know. Right? I was like, oh, my God.
What do I do? Yeah.
So I went to Perth. I was hanging out with some of the lads, and then I get a call from agency going, guess who's going to be working for Steven Spielberg? I was like, me? She goes, yes, you just got booked. I was like, oh, my God. So I called my wife. I was like, and she was teaching at the school that night, right?
Yeah.
And then I was like, just get us up. Come over here. We're celebrating. So we got one of our wonderful acting teachers to sub. She took a flight, came to Perth. My dad comes out with a bottle of champagne. First time ever he's looked in my eyes and is just like, I'm proud of you. You walked away from what I want you to do and you've done it. You succeeded. And I'm like, this is amazing.
The next morning, we get a phone call from the agency, on a deal memo, everything. Yeah, and they go, Fox wrote the role out last night. They cut the role last night. The role's not yours anymore.
We're both feeling your pain right now.
They cast someone else.
No, they cut the role. Cut the role, right?
Still really shit.
It is so shit. And I just saw failure, okay? I was just like, that's just...
Professionally punched in the face.
That's punched in the face. Yeah. And over and over and over again, I have lost count of that. And what that was failure in me, you know, like my inability. And that was so difficult, and especially when it was repetitious. Like, and then as I was kept going through that stuff, I'm like, okay, if I let this failure, if I don't succeed from this, then who am I? I'm that bitter actor that's just gone down, 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 and all my stories are negative. All my experiences are negative. So I had to figure out how I have to turn that into a success.
It's also that funny thing about how we perceive things differently, because to me, you succeeded.
Yes, yeah.
But I can completely see both sides of it.
Totally, and it's all perspective, you know? We're always looking at someone, you know, and like, you know, it could be absolutely anything. Grass is always greener, and that was my problem. I kept kind of like going... Well, I'm a failure because, like, look at this person. You know when you do that thing where you compare yourself?
Yes. No.
Right? Oh, no, right? Yeah, I have no idea. It's such a brand new concept.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and the actors do that. You're like, well, yeah, but they look like me. Everything about them is me, and but they're doing this, and they got a better agent, and they're booking, and my God, I was, like, at the top of the list at doing stuff like that, right? And then I had to kind of change that into a success. And then you do a whole bunch of stuff, you know, where you kind of like going, yeah, but, you know, I did that. You know, yeah. I got myself there. And, you know, my wife is so amazing. She helps me so much with that kind of world because, as you said, you're like, yeah, but I see that as success. And you're like, but I'm in the woods, man. I don't see that as success.
When you're in the woods, you do.
You're in the woods, you don't want to see it, right?
You just see trees.
No, yeah, right. And it's really funny, actually, because, like, that's been happening to me so much. And that actually just happened to me on this new show, Doctor Doctor. And just a couple of days ago, I was... doing something, and I'm sitting there looking out on the street, and someone's just looking at me, just staring at me. Did I try and suss out who I was? I'm looking over at it, and it's Claudia Carvang.
Yeah. Mm.
And she's like, I thought it was you. I was like, hey, Claudia, because she did Doctor Doctor. And when they were having a little chat, and she goes, oh, chum, you know, we tried, we did everything. I was like, I know, Claudia, I know, it's really bummed, I would love to. And then she's kind of like, and I said, she said, chum, I get it. Even in my career, you know, my God, you know, where you just get it. And we do look at that as failure. And then as I was walking away, she kind of called out. She's like, chum. That's why she goes, would you do anything else? And I was like, no. And she goes, yeah, neither would I, right? And we just smiled at each other and laughed.
I think this is actually my last little quote in my book. I've literally written a novel. Would we do anything else? I don't think we would. And it's been so lovely to talk to you today, chum. Anytime I can get in a room with you, mate, is always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. And I also want to thank both of you for doing this, you know, this act of storytelling. It's something that, you know what, when I was at my growing stages, I had a podcast like this, I would be addicted to it. I would be. You know, I grew up in a time where we didn't have any of this. We didn't have it, you know. We'd go hunting for it. And now there's, you know, people like you who are kind of like, oh, you know, I want to empower, I want to inspire. And it's up to all of us, the viewers, the listeners, the practitioners, to get involved with this, support it, listen to it, because you never know what little thing happens here that changes the whole game for you. You know, it's one little thing that someone says that you go, I don't even remember that, but it's stuck with me forever.
It's in there,
yeah. And it's the one thing that could change the whole game for you. So thank you so much, guys. Congratulations. This is amazing.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Awesome interview.
Man likes to talk.
Man loves to talk.
And has a lot to talk about.
And he's such an interesting dude, isn't he?
He's great.
Like, he's so good. But look, one of the takeouts I had, and this cannot be said enough, I loved this. Remember I said in the interview, I literally had like a novel of things that he said. But this one stuck front of mind, which was, you are your obstacles, not your successes. I loved the idea that success isn't enough and it can be driven by ego. You know, that's one of those things. But framing each day and it being a new challenge, and the things that you find challenging and difficult are the things that will define you as a person.
So even your obstacles are your success.
Correct. And they're your unique success too. They're uniquely you. It just takes the pressure off things, doesn't it? And particularly pertinent for me, especially talking about anxiety and things like that, a really beautiful way to start to look at the things or the challenges in your life and twist them or turn them into a positive.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely. And it's about that idea of, I think I mentioned it at the top, of allowing yourself things.
Yes.
And also from my book recommendation earlier.
Yes.
But yeah, and I thought of it also when he was talking about the idea of the 1% and imperfection versus perfection and what we're actually trying to do in a class or even on a project. Because by the time you've worked on a show, whether that's film or stage, you'll come out of it and you will have learned something creatively. And if you haven't learned something creatively, then why did you do it? And that's that idea of, if you went in and you delivered perfection and there was nothing to learn, it wouldn't be a process that moves you forward. It wouldn't be like life.
No. And there's always something to learn, even if you think there isn't. Do you know what I mean? It's about digging into
especially
it.
Especially when you think there isn't.
Yeah,
yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's the time where you need to dig deeper.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So,
how do we use that in our months ahead?
Good point. Good point. Do you want me to talk about my month first?
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Okay. There is so much freedom in my calendar right now, Lauren Bailey, and this is a wonderful thing. There is just so much to be done. I am going to write this show. I am going to go and find this little cabin and be a Yeti and spend a couple of days out just writing and auditioning. What a bloody wonderful experience that is. I haven't had that for 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
I went to an audition the other day and it was like, I remember this. Isn't this fun?
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So there's a few positive things going on.
And obviously, because you signed with New Representation earlier in the year.
Yeah. So now I get the opportunity to really, I guess, show them what I'm capable of in the audition room. And hopefully they're good things. But there's also...
Nothing too perfect.
But it's so true though, isn't it? And you take that into the audition room, that whole idea of imperfection. It's wonderful because that's the magic and the things that you sometimes go, oh, I felt really weird about that. But sometimes it's the things that...
That you feel weird about that they're going to love.
Indeed. So there's that. There's an opportunity now to focus on the podcast, especially with our connection with Earbuds now. And a couple of little projects maybe in the works for us, Lauren.
Yes.
Maybe another film, maybe some speaking projects.
Maybe. Definitely. Definitely another film. Definitely speaking project.
Yeah.
What's all this maybe business about?
I love it. So that's my
month.
Give
me another project to work on.
Yeah. That's my month. It sounds like my next 6 months, to be quite honest. But, it's a positive thing having this freedom in the calendar.
Yeah, I mean, it all ties together, doesn't it? And that's a fantastic thing about this podcast. There was so much that Chum said that feeds directly into how I feel I work. And that idea of flipping things and allowing yourself space tied in with, I'm just going to keep focusing on this idea of an image or many images. I want lots of images.
Yeah.
I realized recently that I, unbeknownst to me, have had an image or had images at various times for what's happening with the film. And sometimes those unconscious images have been blockers.
Right.
And sometimes they've surprisingly been things that have helped.
But even if they're blockers, by then realizing that image is a block.
Yeah, realizing that they're there and going, oh, that image is there. Mm. What do I replace it with? Yeah, so there's a big focus on that for me in the month ahead. And I do just want to also recommend a few things because obviously exciting things are happening. I'm in a show that is opening in a couple of days.
Ooh, yes. You ready to go?
Thanks. I've got a little bit of work left to do. I mean, isn't that the beautiful thing about being in a stage show, though?
Yeah.
You just get to keep discovering.
It's a living thing.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So a quick plug for Anno Zombie, which is on from the 6th of September to the 16th, Chapel of Chapel. It is a zombie comedy set in Melbourne post a zombie apocalypse. So that should be a lot of fun. And on the back of that, I've just been cast in Cuckoo, which is 15 Minutes from Anywhere production with director Beng Oh, which will be on from October 31st. So I'll talk more about that next month, but that's super exciting.
Busy month.
And I want to mention that this month is Oxjam, a month-long music festival, which is held primarily in August. to raise money for Oxfam's efforts in fighting poverty around the world. Now, there's still a few gigs that are coming up this month. Right. And I want to do a shout out for a gig on Friday, September 15th at the Evelyn, Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, which is headlined by Afrobeat-influenced funk band.
Love it.
Which just sounds so cool.
It does.
The 7-Ups. Last podcast in our Artist Toolkit section, I mentioned Trent, who helped me add a little bit with my spoken word item.
Yes. I remember that.
And he and his band, Ivory Elephants, were up in Sydney that weekend playing a gig.
Yep.
So he's also part of the 7-Ups and they are headlining the event, but there's some other fantastic things happening. And I'll throw up a couple of links online because it's just all round. It's a fantastic thing to be part of.
Great cause. And, you know, that spoken word, tell you what, if that doesn't get a tour around Australia at some point, that was great. Just want to once again clarify that I'd had no help. And it was quite obvious.
Hey, I loved the limericks.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks.
So that brings us to the end of podcast 3 for chapter 2 of The Act of Storytelling. And if you're excited about the new shape and focus of the podcast or have any feedback for us, we would love to hear from you. Hit us up on Facebook or at theactofstorytelling@gmail.com. And of course, we would love for you to leave us a review on iTunes. That would be amazing.
Make our day. And remember, we have a network of resources and things that you can engage with. So we do have a GPS tour, which is called Every Laneway Has a Story. And you can download that on the VoiceMap app.
You can also make a one-off donation through our website at theactofstorytelling.com.au. Donations of $10 or more receive a very cool Taos bookmark designed by the wonderful Bethany Smith. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to be a patron of the podcast, for as little as $1 a month, you can sign up at patreon.com/actstorytelling.
Yeah, great. Excellent. It's $1 a day. Come on, people. Get involved.
A day. It's $1 a month. Settle down.
I was hoping for $1 a day. Sure.
And just before we go, I also want to do a big shout out to Anita Quayle again, who created the wonderful music for the podcast.
Genius. On that note, continue to join us on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening.
Earbuds, Melbourne's podcast network. Earbudsnetwork.com.